I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Lucy Moore. She is an environmental and public policy mediator and consultant, and she's author of a couple of books. The new one is called Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator. And she will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore this Thursday, the 18th of July, at 6 o'clock in the evening. And she'll be there along with the wonderful James McGrath Morris. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, being an environmental mediator, first of all, what is a mediator? What do mediators do?
Yeah, a mediator is not a meditator. I sometimes get people that have looked in the phone book or whatever, they'll call up and they'll say, well, now do I bring my own cushions?
Oh,
or,
yeah, Lord.
I know. So it's a very important and very basic question.
Yeah, the letter T.
That's right. Save one letter. So the key thing about a mediator, a couple of key things. One is the mediator has absolutely no stake in the outcome of the dispute. And the second thing is the mediator, it helps the parties come to their own solution. A mediator never, tempting as it might be at times, never comes up with the solution. So an arbitrator eventually will say, I've heard everything I need to hear, and this is how this is going to be. And a mediator never does that. If the parties, whether it's a divorcing couple, whether it's, as I work with 10 different interest groups around a table, arguing about an environmental issue, if they can't come to their own solution, which hopefully I guide them through a process so they can do that, if they can't come up with anything, they don't. That's that.
Now, one of the ways that you define mediator is a person who lets everybody hear each other's story, something like that?
Right, right. I really think there are all kinds of fancy definitions for mediation and what the mediator does, but I really think that's the heart of the matter, is that we each have got a story to tell, many, many stories, but at any given time, kind of the key story about where we're at, and that people that are in conflict together have definitely got a core story to tell. And if we can express those stories and hear each other's stories, we can build a foundation, a human connection with each other that will get us toward then working on some kind of solution. People often think that the answer to resolving a dispute is, well, if we only could get enough data on this particular subject, or when my model of groundwater quality is completed, then we will have, the answer will be very clear. Or when this lawsuit gets settled, then it will be very clear. And I really don't think it's about that. I think it's about people connecting and figuring out their own solutions based on their personal connections. If they can't make that connection, all the data, all the lawsuits, all the information in the world isn't going to mean anything to them. They will block it out. They won't hear it. They won't want to understand it. They won't want to look at it because they're not in a position where they can relax enough to trust and open up with each other.
Right. I mean, it underlines once again that all of life is actually about human relationships and human and environmental, all life relationships, and those interactions are what it's all about. And there's a lot of mistrust. In a place like New Mexico, there are, and you talk about this early in your book, you have a meeting with people about water issues, and they just look at you and say, you're a white outsider, and you're probably working for a foundation, aren't you? And there has been a tremendous amount of mistrust of foundations.
Exactly, exactly. That was a very painful early learning experience for me doing this kind of work in New Mexico, and a really important lesson that I'm very grateful for. I was not so grateful at the time because I was in a lot of pain over it. But yes, the idea that outsiders like me, I've been in New Mexico since 1975, but still consider myself certainly not a native and an outsider in a lot of respects, and just the idea that we can come in with connections to foundations, with political connections perhaps, or whatever, educational advantages, and decide in a sense what is needed for northern New Mexico, for instance, how to help with all the good intentions in the world. We arrive wanting to help desperately, but without really the understanding that we need to listen and learn from these people that were so eager to help. And so that was a very early lesson and a very important one.
We're talking to Lucy Moore about her book Common Ground on Hostile Turf. There is a very poignant chapter in which you describe a group of people who are grazing sheep in a way that they've been grazing sheep, gathering wool, and weaving for really hundreds of years. And the land that they had been grazing on for untold generations suddenly becomes wildlife conservation, and they're not allowed to graze their sheep, and there's literally no place for them to go. And this becomes a conflict between environmentalists and local people who've been here for a very long time and who aren't going anywhere. And you paint this picture of environmentalists as sort of naive, well-meaning nomads who swoop into one place, try to help, and then kind of, well, if it doesn't work here, we'll go save some other part of the planet kind of thing. Whereas the people, the New Mexicans, are like, we've been here forever. This is our land. Do you think we have not been good land stewards? And it's a fascinating portrayal of the deepest kinds of cultural differences.
Exactly. And again, that was a key case for me early on in my career to work with. It was the Ganados del Valle Wool Growers Co-op up north, and a group of environmentalists in Santa Fe, and who, just as I explained about myself coming in with foundation connections and wanting to help the environmentalists, I put myself in that same kind of camp of being idealistic and thinking that we know what is needed. And they had come in the same way with some very rigid ideas about what is good for the land and whether or not sheep grazing is compatible with wildlife management. And that was really the heart of that particular dispute. Could you graze sheep in a wildlife management area? And the environmentalists had to realize, first of all, how they were perceived by the local people. And it was very confusing for them and hurtful for them to realize that they weren't the good guys. I remember meeting with the wonderful David Henderson, who has left us, very unfortunately. He was beside himself because he said, we're the ones that usually are holding baby harp seals, and we're the ones that everybody is sympathetic to and wanting. We're on the winning side, and we're not in this case. We're the evil guys. We're the guys that are trying to shut down this traditional culture, and I don't understand it, and I don't want to be in that position. That, you know, for him to be open like that and for his colleagues to be open and willing to learn how it was they were seen and to really give some deep thought to how to care for the land in a compromising way, in a sense, is very difficult. Environmentalists, like many of us, are incredibly passionate.
There can be a fundamentalist streak. But, I mean, I think one of the ways environmentalism is going is realizing that people live on the land. And this is an example of that. We've also done programs about wildlife conservation in Africa, where if you try to build wildlife areas and don't take into account people, it is just certain failure.
Right.
But, I mean, the thing that was painful for me reading this chapter is that they didn't... It was so condescending toward people who had been grazing sheep for hundreds of years. It wasn't like this was a mega cattle installation where they come and graze the land to bare earth and leave it destroyed. It's people who actually know way more about that piece of land than those who were trying to save the wildlife on it and who'd been doing it in an environmental way. And it's like, why is that compromise?
Right, exactly. And the evident, the very fact that the environmentalists who moved here, and I think all of them had moved here from somewhere else, moved here because it was so gorgeous. You know, one of them said, well, I've just lived all over the country, but this is the most beautiful, the mountains of northern New Mexico. That's where I knew when I saw them I had to be there. Well, how did they get so beautiful, and how did those valleys that are grazed all the time remain that way, as you exactly say, through the stewardship of the people that have been there forever?
Now, that chapter has a kind of surprise ending in it, which I think I'm not going to let people know, because It's extremely interesting, and it's a book so worth reading, Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator. One thing that one does while reading a book like this is I imagine myself in your position, Lucy Moore, being among all of these people who are feeling hostile toward one another, sometimes hostile toward you. You might be perceived as being on one side or the other, even though you're the supposedly neutral mediator. And just on an emotional level, I mean, these debates about policy and about the environment, about ways of life, are ultimately deeply emotional situations. How do you handle it? How do you keep yourself in a place of balance?
That's a really good question, and I think I'm just constitutionally put together to be able to do that. I care deeply about people. I believe that those human connections are all we have to offer each other when it comes right down to it, and that the common ground we can find among ourselves and those connections is the only thing that's going to save us. And so I just put my energy into that. If I do think that I come home sometimes, especially if I've been with a group that's in a lot of pain, a lot of historical pain, or I did some work out at the Homestake Uranium site. I ran a community meeting out there for EPA that I talk about in the book. And those people have been so abused and are suffering enormous health and economic and social and cultural abuses that are just really unfathomable. And as an empathetic person, as you and I are, you take that with you. And the problem is that in the work I'm doing, there isn't anything I can do about that. Some things I can help find solutions to, but a situation like that, I can't do anything about. And those are the tough ones.
There's also the fact that you are continually faced with unwieldy bureaucracies that aren't always talking to each other, aren't always coordinating with each other, probably more often than not aren't, and so many people whose lives are affected, sometimes horribly affected, by these gigantic bureaucracies. And if you're a land-based person, bureaucracy shouldn't even really have to exist, and instead it rules your life.
Right. Think of a land-based community in northern New Mexico. I mean, everything is connected. And a lot of times I work with tribes, and they're mystified by the divisions of U.S. bureaucracy. Why is there a Forest Service, and then why is there a Department of Interior that deals with water, and then why on earth would you have wildlife in the Fish and Wildlife Service? And why would there be a Department of Education when all of those things, our youth, our elder care, the health of our land, the health of our wildlife, our cultural survival is all one thing? And so it's very difficult for people in that position, and you can understand it. It makes a lot of sense. Very hard for them to deal with what comes at them in terms of decision-making about important aspects of their lives. The Department of Health comes in with something that makes no sense to them in terms of the education of their young people or in terms of collecting traditional plants for medicinal purposes, and they can't get at the problem because everything is siloed, as they say these days. And
yeah.
And from the bureaucratic point of view, I'm sympathetic to them too. I mean, if you're with the Forest Service and somebody comes to you with a problem relating to the Forest Service and you're dealing with it and with forest issues, and all of a sudden you're talking about sacred sites and about the importance of keeping traditions alive, that Forest Service bureaucrat has a very tough time dealing with that. They want to take care of it. They've got a job to do, and they want to be responsible. They want to take care of it, and yet that's outside their bounds. So all they can say is, well, I don't really have anything to do with that. And that adds, just piles onto the frustration of, oh, my God, the U.S. government comes, and then they tell us all this confusing stuff, and then they can't help us anyway. And they don't, you know. So it's a deep mismatch of world views.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is this is the thing. I mean, these cultural differences are so profound. It's not like, you know, we eat spaghetti and you eat something
right,
else.
Right.
And when you were talking about all these different bureaucracies and all these different specialties, it really sounds for all the world like different approaches to medicine. Like, are you treating the whole person, or is like, okay, you go to the dermatologist for this and you go to the lung doctor for that, but in fact those things are related, and if they were seen as being related, we could get healthier a lot faster.
Exactly. That's a great analogy. That's a great analogy. Yeah.
So 25 years of mediation, what's the perhaps biggest thing that you have learned about doing your work in all this time?
I think probably the biggest thing is that it is much simpler than I ever dreamed. And I think that a lot of mediators out there would benefit from simplifying, reducing what it is we do down to some very bare essentials about helping people understand each other. And that if we can do that, we can deal with the technical parts, the informational parts, the complex parts, much more easily than we thought we could. In the beginning when I was a mediator, I thought, oh my God, this is such an overwhelming job. I've got to master hazardous waste siting in the United States. I've got to understand this toxicity on the water and this and that in the air. And that's just, I don't need to do that. Maybe I've gotten tired after 25 years and don't want to do it, but I really don't think it's necessary, and I really think it actually kind of gets in the way. So my message to fellow practitioners, and more importantly to all of us out there who find ourselves in conflict, whether one-on-one or whether some big neighborhood thing or something bigger than that, is to listen, is to be respectful to that other side that you may be demonizing, and they may be demonizing you. You're gonna have to get past that. You're gonna have to settle down, listen, learn, and be very thoughtful about what the future holds and what the best solution is going to be.
Lucy Moore is author of the book Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore this Thursday, the 18th of July at 6 in the evening. She'll be there with James McGrath Morris. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's always a pleasure.